note.
Because the more we know about the Ebola virus, the safer we will be. That is especially true for the Harborview nurse you're about to meet. Good morning. I'm Bill Radke. Harborview critical care nurse Roy Godwin will tell you how he is preparing for the possibility of an Ebola-infected patient. You'll also meet the Seattle woman who turned her camera on her alleged groper and found out there was even more to him than she knew. And on a lighter note, Seattle's ramps to nowhere are coming down this weekend. On our Facebook page, we're asking you, what is your most vivid memory of this city ruin? And if you could preserve the ramps in a different context, what would you do with them? We will share your best stories and ideas later this hour. You can hop on there right now, our Facebook page, KUOW Public Radio, and we'll include you. We're also live tweeting this hour, as always, at KUOW. And our phone number is 206-685-2526. 206-685-BLAM. With Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel, C.R. Douglas, political analyst at Q13 Fox, and Chris Vance, Republican public affairs consultant, former chair of the state Republican Party. Welcome, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Ebola is very far away from Seattle. It is very hard to catch. But our next guest cannot afford to not think about it. Seattle's Harborview Medical Center has volunteered to take Ebola patients. Roy Godwin is a critical care nurse at Harborview. Roy, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
How is your week?
My week is good. It's very busy, and things are changing every day.
First of all, Roy, why would this hospital take in any Ebola patients when we have specialized isolation centers in Atlanta and Omaha and Bethesda, Maryland?
Well, we have to be prepared to take an Ebola patient based on the fact that a patient may present to our emergency room or to one of our clinics with Ebola symptoms. Somebody may present with symptoms that has traveled to West Africa. So at the very least, we owe it to ourselves and to our community and to our patients to be fully prepared and ready to take care of a patient prior to further assessment and perhaps their transport to one of the biocontainment units across the country.
Yes, that's always possible. What do you think the odds are of a patient being sent from someplace else to Harborview for treatment?
I think right now those odds are very, very low that a patient would be sent here for treatment if they've already ruled in for Ebola. That I'm not overly concerned about. I still am concerned about the patient that would just show up with signs and symptoms of Ebola.
Some Seattle area nurses have said they don't have the training they need to deal with Ebola. How prepared are you and the doctors and the nurses and the hospital housekeepers at Harborview?
You know, our preparation is ongoing. It does change every day as our physicians, our infectious control program is in contact with the CDC as well as doing further examination of how best we can manage a patient with Ebola. And that involves in terms of proper placement, identification, how best to prepare the staff in donning and doffing of our protective gear and equipment so that we can maintain not only our own safety, but the safety of all of our patients in the hospital.
You say preparations at Harborview are ongoing. At this Dallas hospital, nurses complained that preparations were shifting. We're not talking about the same thing.
I don't think so. There are daily meetings about are we doing the best that we possibly can, and each department is constantly right now assessing, do we have the proper and appropriate equipment? What is our plan if somebody comes in? What are we going to do in terms of, and that goes from everybody from the folks who would greet somebody in an emergency department or the clinic all the way up through high levels of administration. What is everybody going to do as a team to make sure that we all stay safe?
Okay, Harborview Medical Center critical care nurse Roy Godwin is our guest. So if an Ebola patient shows up at Harborview, Roy, what is your job? You do what?
I'm a critical care nurse in the medical cardiac ICU, so I hands-on for first-line care of a patient.
Hands-on, you're cleaning bodily fluids, you're doing all the care.
I'm drawing blood, I'm suctioning them if they're on a ventilator, I'm bathing them, I'm providing direct hands-on care while the patient is in a room or in a bed.
Well, the head of the Centers for Disease Control just told Congress that officials still don't know exactly how two nurses in Dallas got the Ebola virus from that Liberian man. How do you react to that?
It's concerning. It worries me. It frightens me a bit. However, I know that I sort of can't just stop because of that fear. I have to seek out more knowledge and look at what is the best and appropriate protocol so that I can keep myself safe. And it is very concerning that those nurses became infected. And I know that certainly it is possible. However, I'm convinced that we do have the knowledge. We unfortunately have we can learn from what they did or didn't do in Dallas so that we can protect ourselves more effectively.
So then tell us specifically how you stay safe. How do you take off that? I mean, you're one of these guys wearing the full hazmat suit, right? The bubble suit.
We would go in wearing the protective gear, the protective suit.
How do you take that off and not have any contaminated fluid touch you? How do you do it?
When we come out of a patient's room, while we would have on the protective gear, somebody would assist us and watch us as we took off each layer of protection. We would also wash our hands in between while our hands are still gloved with one of the layers of gloves that we have on. But somebody would watch us, and we are having drills to see how safely we can do that and just to determine where our errors may be. But somebody would watch us as we do it, and it's very systematic, methodical as we would do it. And it would be slow to make sure that we maintained our safety.
You don't sound terrified, but you could be forgiven. How much have you considered, if an Ebola patient arrives, just calling in sick?
I would not call in sick.
How do you deal with this? What is this like for you? What's the difference between you and someone who would be really scared?
I'm confident in my skills, and I'm confident in our preparation right now. And although I know we have more preparation and much more training to do in order to meet this need of our community and of all our patients, as well as of one another, I know that I have people who have my back. I don't feel like I'd be going into this alone, and I feel that as more knowledge presents itself, I strongly believe that we can take care of someone safely, and that's something I'm confident we can do.
What drives you to do a job like that?
I love taking care of people, helping them out, watching people go from a state of being sick, where they require my help, to where they're independent and can leave and return to their lives and be happy, healthy, and successful.
Roy Godwin is a critical care nurse at Harborview Medical Center. My guests here on The Week in Review might have a question for you, too. Joni Balter?
Well, I'm listening to you, and you would not call in sick, and you would be ready to switch into the hazmat suit. As I understand it, you're not wearing it today, for example. You don't have a reason to wear it. At what point, you know, sort of in the intake of patients and sort of the beginning of treatment of patients, do you then switch to, okay, we're in at least the preparatory phase for this, and I better put on my hazmat suit and I better sort of change what I'm doing?
Well, immediately, if we had a patient with suspected Ebola and they would have to meet certain signs and symptoms, are they having diarrhea? Are they vomiting? Are they febrile? Do they have a high temperature? Have they traveled to West Africa, or have they been in contact with somebody from West Africa? That would put our entire medical center into a heightened state so that we could ready ourselves to take care of that patient, and that patient would be isolated as quickly as possible. And from that point forward, anybody participating in the hands-on care of that patient would be donning the personal protective equipment.
Harborview critical care nurse Roy Godwin, I'd like to pass on a message to you from our Facebook page where Andy writes, "I'm impressed by the bravery and character of those who run toward danger and disaster to help others, those who don't hide, panic, or blame, those who don't feed, spin, or use the fear derived from the problem but try to help solve it."
Thank you for those kind words. It's greatly appreciated.
Roy Godwin from Harborview, thank you.
You're welcome.
The Seattle King County Public Health Department calls the risk of an outbreak in the United States very small and says if an infected person arrives in King County, our health system is prepared to respond and limit spread of the disease. Remember, someone infected with this virus is not contagious until symptoms appear. According to the CDC, the virus is spread through direct contact with bodily fluids and not spread through the air or by water or by food. You can find out more at kingcounty.gov. This is KUOW's Week in Review. Back in a moment. With C.R. Douglas and Joni Balter and Republican public affairs consultant Chris Vance, I'm Bill Radke with the Week in Review. Let's get a little political, shall we? The city of Seattle is the target of a discrimination claim by the mayor's former press secretary this week. She wants at least $1 million in damages. For more on this, we go live to a man who her claim names as a witness, KCPQ 13 political reporter C.R. Douglas. Why are you on this witness list?
Well, I suspect because I'm a journalist, there are a handful of them on there. She's trying to build the case that her performance was good and that she was dismissed because of her race. So I suspect she's calling journalists to vouch for how she was for those first 3 months or so. I don't know. I haven't talked to her. I've had no contact with her even since she was in office, on only a few occasions where as a press person covering a press conference, we would go and she would hand you the press materials and that kind of stuff. I mean, that was my interaction with her. It was all fine. I didn't have any problems with it. She seemed competent at that. However, there was a whole bunch of problems with the communications regime, if you will, of the Murray administration for those first 3 months. I mean, problems with press releases, problems with, actually his strategy, PR strategy during some of those police discipline cases. So I don't have any inside information about sort of who was responsible. Clearly, she's trying to deflect blame to people above her. She was only one person. I mean, she reported to a communications director. The mayor was clearly involved in a lot of these decisions, so it's kind of a fight between who was responsible for the problems of those first 3 months.
Someone want to remind us of the press secretary snafus?
Well, there were a couple of that happened really one right after the other, and that were kind of high profile. So in one case, there was an ill-fated press conference having to do with police discipline. Some of the police discipline cases, correct me if I'm wrong here, were dismissed. And then the interim chief Bailey wanted, to explain, and Mayor Ed Murray doubled down at that point with this Friday afternoon press conference in which he said he was with his interim chief. He didn't really know enough about what was going on at that point. That was a moment for silence. I don't know if the person filing the lawsuit said, let's have the press conference or let's not have the press conference. But that was one they want back. They certainly should. The other was this press release that went out expressing the mayor's regrets at the death of Jim Deers, who was very much alive. Another person who had worked in the Gary Locke administration, Joe Deer, not with an S at the end, had actually died. But they got this confused. And look, folks know this. If you're a journalist, you know that there's a couple of those kinds of cases where you don't do maybe. Somebody being dead or not dead, check that one. Somebody being guilty or not guilty, you go pretty deep to make sure you've got that exact. And that office, and I don't know who, did not do that.
Chris Vance, former politician, what's your experience with this kind of thing?
Well, I've never been sued. That's a good thing. But there's three dangers here for the mayor. And it doesn't come from this one incident, because this one incident is not going to do tremendous damage by itself. But if you start to see a pattern of either the mayor being accused of discrimination or a pattern of the mayor being sued by staff for any reason, or just general incompetence and turmoil within the staff, then you start to erode the trust in the mayor's office. So the danger here is, if I'm advising the mayor, it's we need to isolate this, localize it, deal with it, but let's make sure that this doesn't start to become a pattern. But it highlights whenever you're a boss, especially in a public atmosphere, terminating people is scary. There's nobody more dangerous politically than ex-employees.
Have you never had a scary firing of one of your Your workers, your staffers, you were a member of the State House, King County Council.
I never have personally, but for 2 years I was the vice chairman of the King County Council, and the vice chair under that structure is in charge of hiring and firing. And we had a few legislative branch employees we had to terminate that we worried would come back. So then you've got to have the lawyer in the room and make sure every step of the process is followed, that there's progressive discipline and that sort of thing. Nowadays, you cannot just fire people. You have to make sure you do it exactly right.
You think the city will settle this?
Absolutely. I'm surprised it wasn't settled by now. I'm surprised it got out. I'm surprised. If you read the quotes from Mayor Ed Murray, you can tell he absolutely hates this lawsuit. It's against everything that he, you know, race and social justice is the core of what he's trying to be about. And here comes this lawsuit that says in this exact office, he comes up short, according to this lawsuit. And he seems mortified by it from what I know.
Yeah, I mean, her claim, listen, you can fire someone if they're not working out. You're allowed to do that, especially, I mean, unless you're a civil servant, and she wasn't. I mean, this was clearly his choice. You can't fire someone because they're black. That's her claim here. She was competent, and it had to do with her race. I mean, she's saying she was the only one who sort of he got snappy with. You know, in terms of like all the others in the office that were white, it was the black woman that he got snappy with.
She told her not to talk to him in the car on the way to gigs?
Yeah. She also claims that after she was kind of demoted from the press secretary office, they kind of put her in another division of city government. And about four others were sort of didn't work out either. White people that were put in another division of city government. And that most of those, all except one, I guess, kind of continued their employment with the city. They sort of got second chances, and she didn't get a second chance. After she was put in that place, she was eventually let go. So she's claiming she was treated differently because of her race.
One little tiny point here is that they should not have, I don't think, brought in someone else and paid them more than she was making, and I think that's kind of a little sticking point here.
Yeah, we're looking forward to hearing more about why that is. In a moment on The Week in Review, do rich people have more access to the government than you or I? We will read some texts when we come back. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. I'm with C.R. Douglas from Q13 Fox. Chris Vance is a Republican political affairs consultant now, former state party chair and office holder, and Joni Balters with the Seattle Channel and Bloomberg View. Our next story on our list here as we run down the week's news, do rich people have more access to the government than you or I? Well, this week, the Seattle Times published a series of text messages between King County's Democratic executive, Dow Constantine, and a major Democratic political donor, venture capitalist Nick Hanauer. Earlier this summer, Hanauer was driving near his home in Shoreline and saw SWAT officers with full body armor, military-style weapons, and an armored vehicle surrounding a house. What the hell, texts Nick Hanauer to Dow Constantine. There was a troop of armed soldiers in my neighborhood and 1,000 police cars. Is this your doing? What is going on? 16 minutes later, Constantine responds, I have no idea what you're talking about. Also, I am not the sheriff. And the Sheriff Comm Center says they don't have any information. Before we go on, former King County Council member Chris Vance, how rich would a constituent have to be before you would answer his emotional texts and contact the sheriff's office for him?
It's not rich. It's how much do you donate? Okay, I mean, mm-hmm. There are a lot of rich people who choose not to get involved in politics. But if you're rich and you choose to make enormous contributions like Mr. Hanauer does, I mean, enormous, bankrolling entire campaigns, then...
Well, he's only contributed, according to the Seattle Times, $5,900 to Dow Constantine's campaigns in the last 5 years.
That's because there's limits on how much you can contribute directly. But if you look at all the ads running right now, for instance, on the gun initiative, the top contributor is Nick Hanauer. I mean, the guy makes enormous
second
contributions.
Second top contributor.
And... In politics, let's be realistic. If you have somebody who's a strong supporter and a big donor, you're going to talk to them and you're going to respond to them. What's outrageous here is the tone taken by Nick Hanauer. I spent 11 years in public office. Nobody ever talked to me like that. If they did, it would have been the last time they ever talked to me. I don't care how much money they donate.
So Dow Constantine tells Hanauer he doesn't know what the sheriff's office is up to. Hanauer writes, "Don't these people work for you? Do we often call out armed soldiers in our country to settle disputes, in our county, sorry, to settle disputes?" The response is, again, "What are you talking about?" texts the county exec. "Was it SPD? Washington State Patrol? As for the sheriffs, I signed their checks, but all police authority was transferred by public approval in the 1990s of a charter amendment to an independently elected sheriff." He's not sucking up to Hanauer here.
No, he's telling the truth. We the sheriff controls the King County Sheriff's Department, not the King County Executive.
I mean, what's so surprising here is that for Nick Hanauer, who's a thoughtful guy, kind of fashions himself a data-driven person, this was a very shoot first, think second response.
It's a text. Don't we all shoot first and think later? What's the big deal?
But that's kind of
the
point.
This is the 500th example of don't text stuff like this. How many times, how many people have to learn it?
He just was a little emotional.
Well, you know, so I interviewed Nick Hanauer on Civic Cocktail about minimum wage, guns, smooth as butter, just absolutely engaging and all of that. But this proves, once again, folks, stay off the text, especially if you're in a heated mood, especially if, you know, you're a little, shall we say, hepped up and can't control the emotions, because it really made him look bad.
I think one thing that's going on here is, you know, this guy's got a big head. I mean, it's been a good year for him. Listen, he basically helped secure that minimum wage deal earlier in the year. He's riding to almost a sure victory on this background check initiative, unless something goes haywire in the last couple of weeks. This guy is kind of feeling like, hey, I got a lot of power here. I got a lot of control. And that seems to be coming out in this text. The context of this was Ferguson. It was happening right around that same time. That's sort of all he could see as he saw this sort of raid going on, that it was somehow police overreach. But he's gotten very you get the sense he feels like he can control a lot.
And this is not the first time. Nick Hanauer blew up at the Democrats not too long ago over education policy. He is part of a group, I think he's part of a group called Democrats for Education Reform, because he wants things like charter schools, and he's not very happy with the quality of the Seattle public school system. And he went out and just attacked Democrats on education policy and threatened to take his money elsewhere. I think Mr. Hanauer thinks he owns the Democratic Party, and it's not true.
Okay, even he might admit that his tone was off, but the guy's driving around in the wake of Ferguson, when former Seattle police chiefs, the president of the United States, and others are complaining about the militarization of police. He sees this. He's upset. It's a private text. Nobody else is dragged into it until the Seattle Times publishes it. Are you being a little unforgiving about some exclamation marks?
Okay, so a text to a government official is not private because we are now reading it. That's the first thing. If you want to talk about the militarization of police, which is a fine topic, let's talk about it. That's where that quaint device, the telephone, comes in. Or maybe go the even more quaint and old-fashioned, go see the sheriff.
So what's so morally better about calling up Dal Constantine and yelling
There's
at him?
There's no printed record of a what looks like a pretty
cheesy. So you're talking about
tone.
Strategy now.
I'm talking about tone. I'm talking about tone and strategy.
And let's talk about the issue a minute. Let's talk about the militarization of criminals, okay? Not a few years ago, you had a shootout in the streets of Los Angeles, more than a few years ago, where the police had standard revolvers and the bad guys had machine guns, all right? So I really don't want to send police into a situation now where you have well-armed, well-funded drug dealers who have military-style assault weapons and Kevlar vests. And what, we want our cops to go in with 38 caliber revolvers like the old days? I think this whole issue of the militarization of police is absurd.
The sheriff of King County eventually was contacted. John Urquhart says Hanauer was wrong, that the SWAT team was justified to protect officers, suspects, and the public. And the two are supposed to meet on Monday, and we look forward to hearing from them. This is KUOW's Week in Review. We'll be right back. Last week, we discussed on this show, Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella said women don't need to ask for a raise because they should have faith that the system will reward them.
It's not really about asking for the raise, but knowing and having faith that the system will actually give you the right raises as you go along. And that, I think, might be one of the additional superpowers that, quite frankly, women who don't ask for a raise have. Because that's good karma. It'll come back. Because somebody's going to know that's the kind of person that I want to trust. That's the kind of person that I want to really give more responsibility to. And in the long-term efficiency, things catch up.
He said he was inarticulate. Later, he said he was wrong, but he didn't say, I apologize. This week, he said, I apologize. But in an email obtained by the Seattle Times, he said, he did say, my advice underestimated exclusion and bias that can hold people back. But he also said, for context, I had received this advice from my mentors and followed it in my own career. I bring this up because I asked two female managers I know, including a former senior level Microsoftie, and both of them said, yeah, he's right. Not about the karma, but that for both men and women, don't focus on asking for a raise. Your boss wants to know what you're doing, how it contributes to the company, your career goals, which might include more money and responsibility and might not. And they've both said they've seen employees who decided, I'm going to stand up for myself and march in and ask for a raise, and that that's not an impressive move. Any reaction?
If he'd have said that his advice was directed to all Microsoft employees, and this is Microsoft's culture that you don't go in and demand a raise, you let the system and your evaluate you and promote you, and then he'd have been fine.
Right.
But it came across as if he was talking specifically about women.
He was asked about women, and he answered about women.
He was at a Women in Technology conference, and so that probably is why he was asked about that. I think, in hindsight, this event was actually a good thing for all of us and for Microsoft and even for Satya Nadella, because this is a first-rate apology. It's late. It's a little late, but it's first-rate in that it doesn't dance around who did what wrong. He says, you know, what he did was just plain wrong, and then he had this nice, clean, clear, I apologize, period. Not if you took offense or if you're messed up or somebody else is messed up. Just full on, I'm going to fix this. And the conversation around this is what has, I think it's helpful in the end, even though it made him look bad.
Tell me what's got you feeling that way, that it's been a good week.
Well, because we all know the technology companies, and there are many of them around here, including the one we're talking about, have a problem with hiring and rewarding women and minorities. And so I'm glad that this happened so that we can get this out in the open and say we should treat, just like Chris Vance just said here, we should treat all the employees the same. We should give them the tools to do well and the tools to ask for a raise if they deserve one.
I agree. I actually didn't think it was late. I mean, it came within a day or two. I mean, he was quick to turn this around. As Joni said, he said, I'm wrong. I was stupid. I said exactly the opposite of what I should have. And you know, hold me accountable, because we're going to do things at Microsoft. We're going to work on pay equity. We're going to work on recruiting more women. I think he's got a Zen-likeness to him that is kind of attractive and sort of trustworthy. I mean, I don't know if the sort of bully Steve Ballmer had done this and then apologized, it would have been different. I think there is.
It would have been louder.
I think there's something to his style that I think he's going to get the benefit of the doubt on this one. And I think his apology didn't hedge, didn't say I was misquoted, didn't say I was out of context. I was wrong, and I can't believe I said it.
And it is another example, as Joni points out, that, and one of the things I do is train clients on how to communicate. And today, you have to be so careful all the time in every setting of what you're saying. There's so many politically correct landmines out there you can step on. You, when you make a mistake, you have to immediately apologize and regroup.
Coming up on KUOW's Week in Review, access to pre-K and how to do it or not to do it. The Week in Review is coming right back. Stay tuned. Chris Vance knows stuff. He used to be the chair of the state Republican Party and King County Council. You're welcome. You can use that. State Representative Joni Balter and C.R. Douglas know stuff, too. Q13 Fox and Civic Cocktail. And we want you to know stuff. So we're running through the big stories of the week and analyzing. Do you want all Seattle children to have access to preschool? If you don't, you could vote no. If you do, then what? Because there are two different initiatives on the ballot, and they compete with each other. C.R. Douglas, which one should we vote for?
Well, I'm not endorsing either one of them, but listen, the fight here is over how broad this effort should be. The unions want basically to deal with the whole child care industry, not just preschool, but daycare, everything from 0 to 5. They want standards for the workplace, wages, all the rest. The mayor and others say that is way too much to deal with. It's too complicated. We're gonna just do a piece of it. We're gonna do 2,000 preschool slots for 3- and 4-year-olds. We're gonna get that right. We're gonna make that work, and then we can sort of branch out from there if we want. So it's a fight over a targeted intervention to sort of this kind of, you know, pre-K group or a very widespread intervention. They tried to come together on this. They had negotiations. They couldn't, and that's why you have two measures.
You're talking about the A and the B.
Correct.
The number is what? What A and B?
Prop 1A, Prop 1A. 1B.
1A and 1B. Would preschool be free to everyone?
Well, Prop 1B is what funds the preschool slots. No, it wouldn't be free to everyone. First of all, there'll only be 2,000 slots, so there's a lot more kids than just that. So it's a limited startup, and it would be a sliding scale. So it would be, you know, depending on your income, you could get full subsidies or partial subsidies or no subsidies. It's not just limited to low income. I mean, you could get into these slots if you were higher income. I assume it's going to be lottery. I don't know how they're going to do it, but it's not reserved just for low income, but there are subsidies for those who are.
So the 1B is a levy, a property tax levy, right?
4-year, $58 million levy that ramps up to 2,000 slots after that 4 years.
$400,000 house, it's $43 a year.
Correct.
So one thing to pay attention to here is just the way this is presented to the voters. You have this funny ballot question. So first they ask you, do you want to do something here? Then they say, do you want to do A or B? And as I understand it, if the first question asked is north of 50%, off you go. Then it is whichever gets the higher number of voters. This is a little weird and a little confusing for voters. And then you get into the particulars, which I thought CR did a pretty good job on, and they are head-scratching when you think about it. So 1A is more sort of broad to the whole existing system, and it deals with training, and it deals with pay, and it deals with a family threshold of payment so that folks can have access to child care and preschool.
And how is 1A paid for? We said 1B is a property tax levy.
1A is not paid for. 1A is sort of creating the beginning of a process to then pay for it or to take it out of the city budget. And in that regard, they have some very wildly varying projections. This is where the voter, I don't know what they're supposed to do here. One is they could do all that they want to do for $3 million a year. Or if you ask the mayor's office and some of the budget folks, they say $100 million a year. Well, that starts to impact the regular city budget rather dramatically. 1B is targeted. It is evidence-based preschool, so it doesn't mention child care for 3- and 4-year-olds, and it pays for itself. So you have this I feel for the voters on this thing, just like I do on the two gun measures, because they're lined up to kind of confuse.
You know, I live in Auburn. I don't get to vote for this. But
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Me too.
But thinking about the region, what worries me the most is gridlock. Republicans and Democrats cannot come together and get anything done in Washington, D.C. or Olympia. And
not a lot of Republicans like that.
And
the less done, the better by government.
I agree with you, and that's wrong. My party is wrong on that. They need to work together and get solve these problems. But what that's leading to is over and over again, Seattle is willing to and forced to go their own way on issues that should be solved other places. Seattle city government should not be involved in education. That's the state's job. The state should be handling early learning, but they're not. The city is going their own way on transit, or at least threatening to. And that, again, that's wrong. That's the county's job. But because they can't solve these problems at other levels, Seattle is going their own way. And that is bad because it's going to make it very hard to get bipartisan agreements, because you're going to see Seattle legislators say, we don't need to compromise now to get an early learning package. We don't need to give the Republicans something to get an early learning package. We've got our own. We don't need to do something on suburban roads in exchange for better downtown transit, because we paid for it ourselves. We have our own streetcars.
So you want a state transportation. So unlike some Republicans, higher levels of government sometimes are the solution, not the most local.
The appropriate level of government. I mean, the main function of local government is law enforcement, not education.
But here's the deal, Chris.
I'm not criticizing.
If we're gonna go with gridlock as our sort of main approach to everything, you're gonna find the cities and sometimes the counties want to be the laboratories of democracy, as they love to say.
They want to experiment
with the minimum wage. They want to experiment with transportation and.
The other thing is, it's nice to say that the state should be doing early learning, but they can't even do K-12. They're never going to get to early learning. So if Seattle wants to do something, it's got to go alone. One thing to say here, the risk in this is, as Joni points out, there are kind of two questions. Do you even want to have pre-K talked about? Yes, no. And then if so, which of these two? Because the fight is getting ugly, because it's confusing, because voters are expected to understand a lot of this, they could lose the first question. I mean, this could just be no.
I'll take that bet.
Based on confusion and kind of with the message be, go back and figure this out and come back with one proposal.
And I'm not criticizing Seattle and its voters for doing what they're doing. It just worries me that they feel they need to do that.
1A and 1B, Thing 1 and Thing 2, are both on the Seattle ballot. Good luck figuring it out. Coming up on KUOW's Week in Review, a Seattle woman turned her camera on her alleged groper and found out there was even more to him than she knew. And you're going to meet her when we come back. KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Welcome back to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Good morning, ladies. You're out for a walk in the city. A man gets physically aggressive with you. Do you ignore him and keep moving? Call 911 or go Marquand on him. Julia Marquand got a lot of attention this week after the Seattle Times told her story. Julia, welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So, wow, how was your week?
Pretty hectic. It's been a whirlwind. I initially thought that maybe this would get enough coverage to make it to the Stranger's online blog. Mm. And that was the top of what I was hoping for. And all of a sudden, I'm in the Daily Mail UK, and it's crazy. It's totally crazy.
You were walking near Westlake Park in Seattle. What did this guy do to you?
So I was waiting in an intersection. It wasn't right in the park. It was on 5th and Pike, right next to, you know, some nice shopping areas. Banana Republic is over there. So I can sense him pretty close behind me at the crosswalk, just enough to have my guard up. And as I'm walking across the crosswalk, I can feel him getting closer and closer to me. And I can even see his shadow starting to overlap with my shadow and getting closer. And I think people have a pretty good natural awareness of how close someone is to them. And when the crowd is not that thick and someone is right behind you, it's pretty creepy. So I'm trying to speed up and veer off to the side to get out of the way in case he happened to just be passing by and it was all in my head. And then that's when I felt him get even closer and then grab me.
You talk as if you've had things like this happen to you before. At least uncomfortable. How often has this happened?
So Being followed and groped in the street, this was the first time that has happened. I've definitely had vaguely similar groping incidences in bars and clubs. I don't know a lot of women that haven't. And the issue of just being harassed in the street, of being followed, of being shouted at, and having crude comments told to you, that happens all the time, almost daily, honestly.
Almost daily. So you saw this guy again a little later. You took out your phone camera. He says, I promise I won't do it again. Please don't take my picture. You said, according to the Times, too late. If you don't want your picture taken, then don't grope women.
True. He also said that, he actually said that after I took his picture. I don't think he realized what I was doing at first. Mm. It took a minute for him to process, and then he asked me not to take his picture, and I had taken 5 by then, so it was done.
I really love this story, and I love your nerve on that. And I think there's a fascinating sort of moment where you had a few choices to make. You had karate chop. I don't know if you know how to do that. You had Twitter, and then you sort of had running across the street, which I'd always been advised that if you're ever in a sort of a harrowing position, that you don't feel comfortable with, dart across the street because these folks don't like it when you do abrupt changes or something like that. Did any of that go through your mind?
When it happened, it was this It was definitely a violation, but I didn't feel like he was going to cause me physical harm. It was just violating. He didn't seem like a fighter. So although I felt shaken up and creeped out, I did not feel like my safety was in danger in a big way. So I think that was one of the reasons I was willing to say something to him and also to approach him and take his picture. And there were enough people around where if he tried to do anything, people would intervene quickly.
You took this photo to the police, the West Precinct. The officer didn't care to see it, which was the wrong reaction. We'll find out more about that. But can you understand his thinking that a photo of some guy saying, please don't take my picture, is not evidence of a crime?
I completely understand that, and I was not at all expecting 10 officers to be sent out looking for him and for him to immediately be shot in the street. I mean, I was not expecting any of that. I wanted the photo to be part of a record, and I wanted it to be compared with other reports of similar incidences to see if this was a repeat offender. I'm fully aware that one photo is not evidence enough to convict, and that's for the courts to decide.
Turned out he was a level 3 sex offender, which we found out after you went to Twitter and got such a reaction, right?
Yeah. I was surprised that it was that level. I'm not surprised that he had groped women before, because you don't just make it to 35 or however old he is and just decide one day, like, I'm just going to do this one creepy thing this one time.
Was that part of your thinking? Like, I'm going to knock this guy off his creepy rails. You weren't totally stunned.
My goal was for someone to recognize him and for him to be outed in his personal life. I didn't think anything would come of it legally, honestly.
I love that social media is now part of sort of public safety.
Well, actually, that's interesting you say that, because you got blowback on your Twitter account, including from people saying it's not cool to publicly shame someone who hasn't been charged with anything. Should we have more internet shaming?
So I'm honestly a little bit conflicted about this. I had no qualms about posting his image because I was there, so I know for sure he was guilty. This could obviously be a weapon used against people who are innocent, and that's problematic, I'll admit it. And I had no idea that this would blow up and that this would set any sort of precedent for what people should do in the future. I will say, to anyone thinking about using this as a weapon, there's no money in it. I haven't even gotten a free beer yet.
Oh, Weekend Review's got to take Julia out for a beer.
You know, this is... I said before I live in Auburn, but my son is a University of Washington student, and even more pertinent, my daughter, 18-year-old daughter, is a freshman at Seattle University. And it is appalling for you to say that this sort of thing happens all the time, but it does. And on multiple levels, we've made multiple policy decisions, which has resulted in this sort of story and resulted in the Seattle City Council holding hearings that there are parts of Seattle that are just not safe at certain times of the day. The sheriff's wife is quoted in the paper saying that she doesn't feel safe walking around downtown Seattle. We need to reexamine a lot of these public safety issues, because the streets of Seattle are not safe right now, especially compared to other major American cities.
Well, yes, CR.
Well, I mean, crime is at about a 40-year low. So
when you don't arrest people, suddenly the crime rate goes down. Well,
I'm not saying we're perfect, but let's just keep this in context.
Listen, we've got other topics to get to, but Julia Marquand, who lived this week, most people would not confront a molester like this. What is the difference between you and them?
I think it's a tipping point situation. I had enough negative encounters in the street, and I was getting increasingly frustrated and getting increasingly bolder in talking back to them, because it's either do this or just suck it up and take it for the rest of your life over and over again.
That's outrageous. You should not have to suck it up and take it. There should have been a police officer somewhere in Westlake Park watching this. I mean, what a novel concept. In other big American cities I've been to, there's actually police officers walking around the streets. You know, which tends to be a deterrent against this sort of behavior.
We've started a conversation that you can continue, dear listener. Julia Marquand, thank you for what you did and telling us your story.
Thank you so much for having me.
KUOW's Week in Review. We'll be back.
normal American city.
KUOW's Week in Review, like I said, we started a conversation that we're still having and that maybe you are too. Chris Vance, former Republican state party chair and council member and state rep and now public affairs consultant. Joni Balter with the Civic Cocktail, and C.R. Douglas, KCPQ 13. And we've got another story to touch on this week. The question is, how responsible is a politician for the misdeeds of his spouse or his fiancée? Oregon's governor, John Kitzhaber, is trying to get reelected, but his fiancée keeps changing the subject by admitting to stuff. And here to tell the story is Salem correspondent Chris Lehman. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Bill.
What has Sylvia Hayes admitted to?
Well, first and perhaps most dramatically, she admitted to marrying an 18-year-old immigrant for money back in 1997. This was a young college student who wanted a green card, and she wanted the money. She says she got paid $5,000 for the marriage, which lasted about 4 years before they divorced. He got the green card, and she spent the money on a laptop and college expenses. They never actually lived together. She says it's an illegal act. The statute of limitations, as far as she's concerned, are over, but the political embarrassment lives on, or actually just came to light last week when news reports first put her on the spot about this sham marriage. Secondly, this week it was revealed that she was in a relationship with somebody who was interested in starting an illegal marijuana farm in northeastern Washington state. She says she never really was a part of that, but she did admit to living on the property, and a real estate broker who helped them with that financially, that is to say, helped negotiate the purchase of the property, says he saw evidence that they actually did grow marijuana there. Again, at the time, not really a kosher thing to do.
Is the bigger deal that her consulting business may have conflicted with her being the governor's fiance?
Certainly in terms of the current political situation, that's a bigger deal. Those other two things, the marriage and the pot farm, are both pretty much ancient history and both happened long before she even met John Kitzhaber, the governor. The alleged using her title to secure private financial gain for herself is something that was relatively recent and could be looked into by the state's ethics commission. So that potentially has a bigger fallout for her in the imminent future.
What does the Republican challenger to Kitzhaber say about this, and what do voters think?
Dennis Richardson, the GOP nominee for governor, is a longtime state representative. He's largely laid off the marijuana farm and green card marriage aspect of it, says it's a personal matter for them to deal with. However, he's going full throttle on the alleged ethics violations and says it's a reason that voters should not trust the current governor, that the current governor is turning a blind eye, he says, to this situation because, well, he's in love.
Wow. What a race this has turned out to be. Salem correspondent Chris Lehman, thanks for telling us about it.
You're quite welcome.
My guests on the Week in Review, any reaction to what's going on in Oregon?
Well, the sham marriage and the marijuana farm is weird, but Oregon's pretty Oregon's used to weird with John Kitzhaber. Guy's kind of a 67-year-old hippie, wore jeans to his inauguration, and they seem to like that. But. And I know this because I am a consultant. You absolutely cannot be a state employee and have an outside consulting contract that in any way conflicts or overlaps with your official duties as a state employee. She has a desk in the governor's office, and it's been ruled that she has to be treated like a state employee. There's no gray area here. She absolutely broke the law in terms of doing outside consulting while sitting in the governor's office.
Joni.
Aside from the outrageous charge of wearing jeans in the context that you mentioned, I would like to point out that the governor himself, these actions are illegal and a little hippie that the girlfriend did, but the governor didn't do any of this. All he did was decide he wanted to marry her.
C.R. Douglas.
Yeah, I think it's probably going to be a wash. I think in a weird way, the pot and the marriage might kind of play well in Oregon. And then, you counter that with the very serious issue about her sort of outside gain using the office as a platform. I don't know that this brings the guy down. I mean, this is a very, very liberal state, and it's an uphill battle for a GOP.
No, but I'm going to go back to what Joni said. The governor did know that she was doing outside consulting. He absolutely knew that, and they announced this week that she would stop taking any money for contracts. But the governor knew about the outside consulting.
I didn't mention that. He appointed a commission to look into it to sort of take it away from himself on that point. I was talking about the marriage in the pot.
Okay, so C.R. Douglas says it'll be a wash, and given the genes, it might be a stone wash. So Kitzhaber will win, though, right? We still think.
Probably.
Yeah, okay.
Oregon's a little less, actually a little more Republican than Washington State, and there is sort of a national tide moving towards Republicans, but it would have to take a big tide to beat Kitzhaber.
Speaking of a big tide, this is the Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. I was only half naked when I jumped off the ramp to nowhere. The ramps are the remnants of a freeway that was supposed to plow through Seattle but was abandoned 40 years ago. You see the forsaken concrete statues near 520 in the Arboretum. I had my pants on when I vaulted off the side as a UW sophomore in 1984. Others wore less. The city is finally demolishing the ramps to widen 520. Floating bridge closed all weekend. And because they're ugly, or Joni, are the ramps beautiful?
Well, I don't personally find them beautiful. I think it's hysterical that some of the people who fought the freeway now are so sentimental about the removal of these. That's just funny.
It is. On Facebook, people were sentimental. We asked for your memories, and Todd said it was a spot to go bridge jumping. It also happened to be a pretty popular spot for kegs. The best was when the cops would arrive. Kids would go scattering like roaches into the sticker bushes and show up at Dick's an hour later with scrapes everywhere. This is what nostalgia does. You're talking about drinking, police, wounds, junk food, jumping off concrete, and it just like you go, ah, that sounds great.
Love that.
Michelle says, when I was a kid, I was always afraid we'd end up on one of the ramps on accident and drive into the water. That is so relatable. That's a kid, right? You see those things? And then how would you preserve them? Kelly says, I'd envision a reclaiming of the ramp by local plants and sculpture. Carol says they should be replaced in marble. Speaking of budget issues, any final thoughts? Ramps to somewhere?
I think I'll be fine if we lose them. Yeah. And I did jump off them in about 84.
Yeah, you were wearing what?
Swimsuit.
Got it. You call it a swimsuit? I call it a birthday suit? You say either, I say either. Chris Vance, naked?
I never jumped off, and I'll have to ask my son if he ever did. Like I said, he's a UW student.
Chris Vance, Jody Balter, C.R. Douglas. Thanks, everyone. KUW's Week in Review back next week. Jason Pagano, producer. Thanks, man.